Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to new and returning listeners. I am Dr. Danica Ramsey-Brumberg, and one of the co-hosts of the New Books and Irish Studies podcast channel for New Books Network. For today's episode, I am pleased to welcome Dr. John Soderberg, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and Sociology at Denison University, and the author of Animals and Sacred Bodies in Early Medieval Ireland, Religion and Urbanism in at Clonmacnoise. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Danica. I'm very happy to be here.
Would you tell us a little about yourself?
Yeah, as you said, I teach archaeology at Denison University in Central Ohio. Before that, I managed the evolutionary anthropology labs at the University of Minnesota. I also did my PhD at the University of Minnesota, working with Peter Wells there. And I also have an MA in Irish Studies from Boston College. As an archaeologist, I focus on animal remains and the insights they offer to us about how people organize their world, you know, partly in obvious ways, like how they get their food and those kinds of things, but also in terms of how we organize our relationships with other people through food.
And for those listeners unfamiliar with your book, what is it about?
The basic question I'm asking is why monasteries became such important places in medieval Ireland. And the book focuses on trying to put together some answers for one place, Clonmacnoise, an important monastery in Central Ireland. I guess I was originally drawn to archaeology as I began to learn how little we know about what life was like in places like Clonmacnoise. You think of all the thousands of people who would have moved in and out of the place, the thousands of people for whom it would have been a key feature of the landscape. And it's really hard to find a lot of evidence about their lives and their motives outside of archaeology. So I wanted to focus on that. And in the book, there's a lot of important work on the ways that places like Clonmacnoise serve to kind of consolidate control over territory and people. But I have trouble seeing that dynamic as enough for explaining why Clonmacnoise became so important. So the book talks a lot about people walking animals to Clonmacnoise. And, you know, those movements would have been essential experiences for all those thousands of people moving in and out of the place. And I think that register of human experience is important. So I'm trying to put together the book as a way to try and figure out how. Why is it important?
And through approaching this with this avenue of research with Clonmacnoise, interdisciplinary research appears to be a cornerstone, because you don't just go into archaeology, you also go into anthropology and sociology, as well as sculpture as well. Why was that a crucial element to your research?
One of the things I've been lucky enough to spend my graduate career in very interdisciplinary places. Irish Studies at Boston is pulling things together. And earlier I said I teach archaeology. I suppose actually what I should have said is that I teach anthropology. And I love how anthropology departments pull together people with just deeply incompatible perspectives on things. And you know, if things go wrong, we sit and stare across the table at each other, not say much. But when we get it right, that just kind of opens up how you can think about things and lets you get out of these little tight communities of assumptions that we, you know, all the zoo archaeologists end up thinking kind of the same way. And so you get out of those little assumptions and you can start to reframe problems and also see the ways in which different disciplines are dealing with the same questions in different ways. So it's a lot of fun. Terrifying too, because, you know, I know I'm getting it wrong when I move outside of my core. And so apologies to everybody out there for the ways I've not tread lightly on the assumptions I should have.
No, but it brings a lot of different ideas together. And I think there needs to be more interdisciplinary. I'm personally an interdisciplinary researcher. So I think there's so much more information we can gain from bringing things together.
I agree. It really does enrich things. Yeah.
So on page 3, I thought this was make a comment, and I think this is really interesting. You mentioned that, quote, devotion to one character occludes possibilities for different tales built around different characters. How did this inform upon your research?
Yeah. And I suppose that in some ways it's a defense of interdisciplinary work. That section of the book, I'm introducing a story from Adnan's life of Columba about, you know, Columba showing up at some farmer's house one night and saying, "Can I spend the night?" And the guy says yes, and he ends up giving him 105 cattle out of it. And scholarship on that little tale is really surprisingly settled. There's a really strong consensus that, you know, kind of gifts like that yield control, and the farmer ends up kind of becoming a subordinate of the monastery, and it gets into lots of thoughts about how clientage work, and you're sort of working in that sort of mode quite a bit. And that ignores this other part of it, which there's a surprisingly little amount of commentary. It says you can use these cattle for anything you want, as long as it's for the purpose of charity. And that, I think that puts an interesting spin on it. If you look at it as, the stranger arriving at the door and figuring out how to take advantage of you. I mean, you're assuming that that's some psychopath that's ready to rage your larder. And that's a choice about how to see what shows up at your door. That the way that we end up making those choices in any one discipline has layers and layers of things which drive us one direction or the other. But we end up focusing on that character to try and make sense of the whole story. And I think there are other ways to look at that stranger at the door.
And then looking at these relations of different people together, one of the main elements of your book is looking at Klamath noise from the urban perspective of looking at it with urbanism. The debate around this, I know it can be what makes a site urban is particularly tricky, especially when it comes to definitions. What makes a site urban, particularly a monastery, and how do you define, quote, the word urban?
Yeah. I think urban settlements are one of the most fascinating things humans have ever done. They are living in a circumstance where a group of people cannot feed themselves. You end up having to look to strangers, to look outside of your own community in order to figure out how to get enough to eat, get enough raw materials to live. It's a fascinating transformation in human society around the world, and it happens around the world. It's something that we get into. I think the questions about the definitions of urbanism get snarled up in answering the question, well, how do people go about getting other people to feed them? I mean, you know, that's the question. And I think a lot of the debates about definitions and what qualifies as a urban center or not, it circle around what qualifies as a legitimate way that people go about feeding themselves. And for a long time, there was a, particularly in the mid 20th century, there was a really strong set of assumptions that the way that happened was to subordinate a hinterland. And so you get kind of this parasitic view of urbanism, and what it is, what, you know, why it is that people give up their food, which echoes back to that story I was telling earlier about Adnan, which is that, and it's the same assumption about who is that waiting at your door. If you think of other ways in which people could make those arrangements work, then you start to get what people usually call other definitions of urbanism, but it's not really other definitions of urbanism. It's other ways that you can accomplish the solution. How can you get people to give you food and all the other, you know, all the other things that go along with that.
And when looking at this within your book, you discuss, I know we talked about this with interdisciplinary before, but you bring up economic and anthropological theory in reference to archaeological sites, but you also talk about the archaeology of religion. In your opinion, why has the archaeology of religion been overlooked or sidelined in comparison to the other ideas?
Yeah. A lot of it is it was the fault of archaeology. For a long time, the real consensus in the discipline is, well, we just can't talk about it. There's an assumption about what religion is, that it's about ideas or something that's non-material in some sort of way. And there was a really strong set of assumptions that archaeologists could talk about how you get food, how you get your raw materials, how you make your stone tools or whatever. But when you start getting at ideas somehow or other, the assumption was that the archaeological evidence just doesn't contain that. So as people's view of what religion is started to shift a little bit, and as people see it more about what people do and how they arrange their lives and the rest of their world, people began to see that it's possible to do an archaeology religion. But a lot of it is, you know, archaeologists just weren't talking about it for a long time. And there's a real sense that you couldn't really talk about it. That somehow or other is speculative as opposed to, you know, other more material things.
How does this then, the archaeology of religion, define an alternative view of the sacred space at Clonmacnoise? And how is this then expressed in the archaeology?
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily define an alternate view of sacred space. There are a lot of strains in religious studies and a lot of ways of understanding kind of how religion sits in the world that see the process of making sacred as kind of pulling away from the world, as creating a coordinate that's separated out from whatever's profane or physical or something like that. And that creates kind of a sense that you're purifying space or you're setting it aside from the rest of the world. What's happened in a lot of areas is that that's kind of set up a narrative that talks about control of the space. You have to defend the border of it. You have to, you know, get a hold of it somehow or other. And that sets up a line of questioning. Well, who gets a hold of it? And it turns out that, you know, people with a lot of power get a hold of it. And then you sort of go along and explain religion in a way that, you know, fits it into kind of political context. And it's a very instrumental view of religion. What I think sets where the archaeology of religion, I think, sets up a different set of possibilities is a perspective that comes fairly recently, but it's been floating around in religious studies that sacred is not about removing something from the world. It's about articulating the world. It's about connecting things together, bundling things together. And there are a lot of traditions where that's a key way of making something sacred. And in that case, the transformation comes out of connecting and articulating, and the transformative possibilities comes out of the way that things are connected. And for me, that's where I think the archaeology of religion starts to give you a different sense of why you have cities, a different sense of why people do all kinds of things in medieval Ireland. So I think that, so it's the view of how religion works as much as just talking about religion, I think. Mm-hmm. That makes sense?
Nope, that makes perfect sense. And then thinking about Clonmacnoise, I did probably put the cart before the horse mentioning it before, but why did you choose Clonmacnoise as your case study?
Yeah, it's a lot of it's luck. I happened to be looking for a PhD topic and looking to get started on all this while Heather King was doing her excavations there. And she was kind enough to let me join and help and then to work on the animal bones. So a lot of it is just good luck and kindness of people saying, sure, go ahead and work on it. I knew I wanted to work on monasteries. I guess as I got further into it, though, what became clear is that whatever is happening at Clonmacnoise was looking a lot like Dublin. And really were in many ways, they just weren't, you know, the archaeology wasn't that different in certain kinds of ways. But whatever is, you know, driving Dublin, it's not the same thing that's driving Naclomic Noise. So you need to have a contextual explanation that makes sense. And whatever is motivating Naclomic Noise is not the same thing as motivating Dublin. So it seemed like a good opportunity to ask some questions of the phenomenal archaeology that Hitta King did there.
And then thinking about Naclomic Noise in this context, how do the sacred and the settlement converge at this particular site?
Yeah. That's where I get into my orientation on people walking animals to the site. I think the settlement and the sacred part converge there. I genuinely believe that part of what makes, and maybe a very important part of what makes the site sacred, is the fact that people were bringing their animals from across, you know, a good section of the area to Naclomic Noise. And, you know, in that image, you get sort of, I don't know, like a Mediterranean sacrifice march or something like that. But they're just brought there for food. I mean, they're brought there to be slaughtered for the most mundane purposes. People are making tools out of their bones and eating them and making, you know, leather out of their hides and those sorts of things. But that is bringing people together from across a huge swath of Central Ireland there, and beginning to create ways for them to connect with each other that wouldn't be possible other than that. And I think, you know, we neglect that as an important piece of why these places exist. And if you think about why these are special places. I was thinking earlier today that Heather King's excavations were in the new graveyard, which is an ongoing graveyard. And, there, while excavating there and while you visit there today, this is still, you know, people are burying their loved ones there. This is deeply personal engagement with the place. And I think there's a long history. I mean, people were bringing things there, connected with it and experiencing the hubbub of being there.
And thinking about these different relations, you talk about with all these different ideas, mm-hmm. how is the relationship of archaeologies of a religion with biology? So bringing those two together, because you look at animal bones within the religious context, how is that similar to the relationship of anthropology and economics, which you also talk about has an interesting relationship?
Yeah, this is a fascinating one. So, we're familiar with neoclassical economics and the emphasis on, you know, maximizing individuals, and you're driven to increase your profits, and you know, the whole society comes out of that. Biological anthropology was even stronger on that emphasis than kind of traditional neoclassical economics, is that, you know, people, beings on the planet, are driven by the need to maximize their reproductive success. And whatever you can do that, you will go about, and you can list all sorts of horrible things that, you know, people do to each other for that reason. Well, and that's set up, you know, with sociobiology, and that's set up a very particular view of humans and human society that was very strong in the mid 20th century. There were dissenting voices to that view all along, that there was something that's being missed in that process, but they got remarkably little traction. And then in the early 2000s, that circumstance changed. And the research coalesced, and there became space for perspectives. And all of this flood of fascinating research came out about how, not in a metaphorical way, not in an abstract cultural way, but on a basic biological and evolutionary level, what's interesting about humans is the degree to which we are evolved to be all entangled with each other, theories of intersubjectivity and those sorts of things, which you normally think of as the realm of cultural anthropology, those kind of things. But there is now a full, robust amount of research in biology about the degree to which that you can identify that set of interconnectedness, and that's that. led to a huge amount of really fascinating research on thinking about, you know, how is it, you know, that human beings to get together, and what's so important about human beings getting together. There's a wonderful book by the biological anthropologist Sarah Hurdy called Mothers and Others, which is grounding the very beginnings of being human in kind of changing around so that we are interdependent on each other and sharing childcare and those kinds of things. And that, so interestingly, that for me became a source of a whole bunch of ideas for how to think about, well, what is different about it? I mean, there is something different about Claude McNoyce, and as we talked about earlier, this long debates about urbanism and monastic towns, that kind of stuff is circling around the sense. There's something there, but it's really hard to grasp. And for me, this research gave me a way to anchor that very clearly in how people act, and to start to get a sense of, well, why is it important that people were gathering there?
And then thinking about these different aspects going on, why do you think that there is such a polarization of concepts then, not just with the biology and religion, but also the profane and the sacred?
I wish I could answer that question. It is a fantastic one. It really is. I mean, those polarities are there, and I mean, maybe we depend on them, that's kind of how we ground ourselves. But, there's been, 20 years now of shouting at Descartes for splitting body and mind and, all sorts of things. I mean, they're very deeply grounded. And it's unsettling when you start to mess around with them. And I think thinking about the stories we started talking out with is helpful because when you start to see that there are these narratives for how we think of ourselves as acting and kind of the fundamental things about what it means to be human, the narratives we have clarify certain ways of being and they marginalize other ways of being. And I think it's certainly helpful to just recognize the existence of it. Why we feel compelled to do that?
We feel comfortable with the black and white, but not necessarily the gray, which most of it is gray.
Something ain't right.
And then in the book, you talk about I've brought this up a little bit before, but the anthropological, humanist, and even economic discourse has not been integrated with the biological anthropology. To what extent has then biological anthropology, particularly zoo archaeology, been overlooked in the study of sacred settlement?
Yeah. I think, when I was talking earlier about, religion and kind of senses of what makes things sacred, the dichotomy underneath that is, the body and the spirit, the body and the mind, and all those sorts of things. Genuinely difficult to figure out, and I'm intentionally framing it this way: what in the world does slaughtering cattle have to do with making a place sacred? I mean, that's addressing that assumption that sacred is about something other than that kind of really basic bodily kind of thing, and that is that change in understanding what makes the sacred is beginning to edge towards that it's possibility for seeing that it isn't. Against being sacred, it's part of the process and connecting with the world around you.
And then taking those these ideas and thinking more physically about the animal remains, what do we know about the animals at Clan McNoyes?
Lots. I think the most critical thing is that the cattle are brought in from somewhere else. They're not raising their own cattle in the immediate neighborhood. They are in a circumstance where they need to figure out a way to get some sort of relationship with surrounding people. And the particular relationship they got was to get the most elderly, most worn out individuals from the surrounding herd. So the people who are walking their cattle to Clan McNoyes are not walking their prize livestock. They are walking the animals who have lived out their reproductive lives, who are no longer main productive members of the herds there. So they're, you know, essentially kind of the excess cattle that they're bringing into the site. Leaving them there, you know, they end up buried there, as people are buried there.
And then, do we see any variations with the treatment of cattle and over time? And are there any variations with the other types of animals that are possibly at comic noise?
Yeah, one of the striking things, and one of the things that led me to think about this idea that walking animals in is crucial to the place, is that it's a through line from the earliest data that we have from Klondike Noise, is probably somewhere around 700, you know, up through 1300. There is essentially no variation in that process. It gets a little bit more so towards the end, so the animals are a little bit older in the final phase, but that is an absolute through line. I mean, that is a coherent core of the experience of being Klondike Noise the whole way through. That doesn't change. One of the big questions, and you know, the monastic town debate is basically a question about what's the role of a market economy in medieval Ireland. For a lot of people, towns are markers of the emergence of a market economy. And it works very well. There's a good reason for that. And you can see lots of fascinating evidence about commodity production in places like Dublin and elsewhere. Faunal analysis has some good markers for that. And those markers really only show up in the final phase of settlement. So when you get into the second millennium, somewhere between 1000 and about 1300, those sorts of markers show up. So you do see that change over time, where you're probably seeing broad shifts in how people are producing and exchanging things. Settlement for lots of reasons ends up drying up essentially sometime after 1300. It's a good question about the exact date of that, that hopefully we'll be learning more about in the near future. But at some point it stops, and that means people stop walking their cattle to Klondike Noise. That is a key end of it. It remains a sacred place. It remains important in certain ways, but the vitality that we associate with it is partly that whole provisioning thing.
And how does it compare the cattle necessarily then to, do we see the same patterns at other settlements, whether that be Dublin or other?
What you asked me, what got me started on Klondike Noise, writings of people like Finbar McCormick and people working throughout Britain, looking at, they're looking at the emergence, the post-Roman emergence of towns. This provisioning thing that I was talking about is a major signature of that. You see it all over the place. So it's again and again that you see it. That is a really interesting way of getting into that sort of situation. But you're seeing it in a very different context in Klondike Noise.
And then how is this concept of entanglement? You talk about entanglement throughout the book. Mm-hmm. How is this encapsulated by the animals?
Yes. In a basic way, the fact that they're there is a demonstration of entanglement. They are connecting, they're entangling whatever the outlying settlements are. And you're asking before about, do you see the same patterns? If you look at, the smaller monasteries, they're farms. I mean, they are operating like you would expect any farmstead to look like, and they are operating the same way. And they're, connecting a certain local group of people, presumably, who are going to be connected with a small monastery. And then that rises to a much larger level of connection at these giant centers like Klondike Noise. And so they are, a physical entanglement. They are connecting and bringing things together from other places, arriving at Klondike Noise. So in some ways, it's that very simple idea of entanglement. You know, entanglement becomes this big philosophical debate, and we'll circle back to what makes it sacred and all these kind of things. But you know, fundamentally, it's, I mean, they are actually entangled. They are exchanging crucial things. And then, of course, movement of people, too. When I talk about walking animals to climatic noise, part of what I'm hoping comes to mind is, you know, walking a pilgrimage. It's that sort of intentional walking, I think.
So that then leads me actually quite nicely into my next question, which is, how did transforming these animals' bodies into food as well as possibly other products make climatic noise sacred and a sanctuary city?
It is what is bringing the place to life. It is literally feeding the settlement in terms of actual food and raw material, but it's also bringing together the life of people. It is what brought people to live there. I mean, it is important to remember these are places where lots of people lived. There are, and as far as I can tell, a pretty wide range of people. And the array of people who would have seen themselves as part of Klamath Noise is quite wide. And you know, that would have been presumably a lot of people throughout the landscape would have felt that identification. That identification is worked out in all kinds of material products. I keep talking about cattle because that's all I see, a lot of cattle. There are lots of things with other animals. I look at them too. But also, I mean, they're bringing products to and the physical movement, the physical arrival of bodies and products at Klamath Noise, I think, is very important.
And then, especially because at monasteries, we tend to think of them as being monks, but there are a lot more, as you said, a lot more people that live there, both secular, whether they're farming, well, not necessarily farming in the urban areas, but making products from those raw materials.
Yeah. And I would assume that the people who are walking their cattle to Klamath Noise, they would feel part of it. They would, the purpose of walking them there is to feel part of this thing. A sacrifice, a devotional act, or something like that. It's not, you know, we think of it in kind of narrow economic terms of, you know, rational maximization of products. It is that, but it's also, these are arriving at a very special place, and they would have been a signature contribution of these people to that place.
Moving from this idea, what I really find interesting is that you actually have a chapter on the depiction of animals in sculpture at Klamath Noise. Why was this critical to include, and how does this complement or contradict the animal skeletal remains?
Yeah. I think we often think of monasteries in very divided ways, where you have a sacred part and you have a settlement part. Certainly, if you look at how people tend to talk about places like Klamath Noise, there's a set of discussions about what the settlement looked like, and then there's a set of discussions about what the sacred precinct looked like. And those tend to be very divided. I think it's fascinating that the animals show up in all their full glory there. And certainly people, for centuries, people have looked at this iconography and it struck them how much of the secular world is there. And some of that is the animals. If you imagine what it would have been like to be walking into these places, I started out talking about, you know, for thousands of people, the signature experience would have been bringing your cattle to Klamath Noise. That would have been the experience, I would think, in a very important way. I can imagine they would have had some sense of what's going on up the hill, but a lot of it would have been probably, you know, hard to grapple with and maybe not the most immediate thing. But imagine if once they make it up the hill or once they get up there, they're seeing the very animals that they brought to the place. There's the famous cats, reclining with mice in their paws and those sorts of things. But that's exactly the kind of entanglement I'm talking about. That is the most sacred central precinct of it. And it's bringing in these kind of mundane, quotidian little pieces of the world or specifically profane pieces, and trying to entangle them, to get back to that word, to mix them all up to create what the experience was. So that's, I mean, I see the animals on the crosses as a great demonstration of how important they were. I mean, they are part of the experience, even at this level.
And they're in very visible locations outside where you would be able to see it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can't imagine that they wouldn't have been as eye-catching as they are to people wandering in now. I mean, as you said, they are right front and center. There's a tradition of looking at the iconography on the cross and whatnot in very didactic ways. And you know, undoubtedly they were teaching instruments, but I love the phenomenological approaches that have taken over in a lot of art history, where, you know, you're looking at how the crosses made you move and how they made you feel and the experience of being around them. And, you know, that fits very well with my sense of what's going on with these places. And trying to fold that into not just kind of a experience of getting people engaged. You can trick them into the didactic stuff or whatever, but that is part of the experience. That these places were intended to make you feel and move in certain ways, and that involves the whole place.
I know we've talked about this a little bit before, but how does Clonmacnoise embody the variety of urbanisms in post-Roman Europe?
The icon of post Roman urbanization are these extraordinary trade settlements, where you're seeing items brought from across the world. And those are often very tightly linked to the development of increased social hierarchies following along. They are associated with that. And then the scholarship on it is focused on that. It's sort of understanding, you know, what is it that re-triggers Roman, post-Roman urbanism? You look to Charlemagne and all sorts of things like that. But there've always been questions about that. And in England, particularly, more so than on the continent, there's been a lingering scholarship of saying, well, yeah, that probably makes sense, but gosh, it's hard to put your finger on where that is. One of the enduringly fascinating pieces of medieval Ireland is that, I mean, whatever else is going on, the social hierarchies are not as well marked as they are elsewhere. And the gulf between various strata, they're there, but, you know, you don't have the accelerating gaps that you do elsewhere. Once you start seeing a similar set of developments, and Clonmacnoise is not the same as Dublin, there are interesting differences, but you are getting a extraordinary concentration of people who are developing this peculiar urban economy. I think that points to, you know, you need to have some sort of different explanation for it. And it's important to observe that Ireland is not special or unique in all of this. It isn't like this stuff, you know, it isn't like something's happening at Clonmacnoise is not happening somewhere else. But because of the differences, I think there are pieces that come to clarity a little bit more easily than they do elsewhere. I think so that's the opportunity to see some of the variety and the whole range of things that we're producing in these kind of places. And all the different reasons why people get together in this way.
And then thinking from the sort of like very big picture to slightly a smaller picture, how does this fit within the early medieval early medieval Ireland? That's what we're focused on, not England, Ireland.
There's been, for a variety of reasons, a strong effort to identify the development of social centralization, identify the development of a market economy in early medieval Ireland, because for a whole variety of really colonial reasons or whatnot, it was assumed that wasn't there. And so it's, you know, the window on the Iron Age kind of thing. In reaction to that, I would say, you know, from the 80s onwards, there's a very strong emphasis on saying, no, the same thing is going on in Ireland. You can see the development of commodity production. You can see all these things that you see elsewhere. It's not something totally different. But I think that can slide off into rejecting ways that it is, in fact, different. I think a lot of the, you know, questions about whether or not monastic towns exist and those sort of things are fundamentally questions about those sorts of issues. There's a wonderful clarity in the mid to late 20th century about what causes urbanism in early medieval Europe. And letting go of that clarity is difficult. And the association with the development of market economy is a very powerful explanation. But I think it's an incomplete one. And this is trying to, partly, frankly, looking back to some of the things that were rejected. So there are some things that are written in the early 20th century that the mid 20th century is reacting to and saying is wrong. And they were right. They were wrong, but they also are worth thinking about in ways that will allow us to understand other things that are going on.
On a slightly different note, in the book, you occasionally explain different elements with case studies. From either outside Ireland, so you give several examples from the United States, or from modern works. What, in that case, I'm thinking of The Motel of the Mysteries by David Macaulay. Why are these important elements to include in your writing?
Mostly because The Motel of Mysteries is just a fantastic book. You guys gotta love it. But it's a great example. You know, the shtick in that book is that archaeologists from, you know, a couple of centuries from now are digging up a motel in the middle of the United States, and they mistakenly think it's a shrine and completely misinterpret the whole thing. So that happens to be a wonderful example of some of the things we were talking about earlier, with kind of misconceptions about what it is that archaeology can do. And it's a good marker for, how people thought of archaeology and how archaeologists thought of archaeology for a long time. Some of the other examples, I think, there are resonances to long debates about, you know, how we think of ourselves and how we, you know, how we understand human society in lots of different places. If you just take urbanism is a fascinating thing that happens all over the globe, completely independently from other examples of it. So different groups invent the urban settlements. It's hard to know how, you know, you can only do so much in terms of pursuing those comparisons, but remembering that these are debates that are much larger than what's the difference between Clonmacnoise and Dublin. I mean, they they're important to remember, because the narratives that are structuring how we understand Clonmacnoise and Dublin are part of these much larger narratives. So the debate about monastic towns is a debate that you know goes back centuries about how we understand this stuff. I think, you know, to acknowledge that helps to see what some of the possibilities are.
I'm adding that book to my list, by the way.
It's got all these pen line drawings in it. It's a great reconstruction of the princess of the Usa people, with a toilet ring on her head. You take a peek at it. It's fantastic.
And then on page 24, you mention your goal for the second chapter is to discuss, quote, what tales do archaeologists tell about encounters among strangers in early medieval Ireland? With that in mind, what tale do you want to tell?
I've intentionally in the book referred to these as sanctuary cities to have resonance with a much longer and ongoing debate about sanctuary cities and the importance of creating spaces for strangers for the health of the whole society. Our ability to be a functioning group depends upon creating these spaces for other people. And we talked earlier about, you know, what is a sanctuary city? It's literally a place for strangers in the city. That you could go and expect to get hospitality, expect to get protection. And there's a bit in the book where I talk about the kind of historiography of sanctuary. And it's another fascinating thing. Most of the historiography of sanctuary is about protecting murderers and, you know, how do you handle criminals and that sort of stuff. And there's this whole other world of sanctuary that is for strangers and for creating that possibility that, you know, the person who shows up your door is not a psychopath who's going to empty your larder. And well, they open possibilities. And that's, you know, we don't need to get into the anthropological theory of it all, but at the root of it, and that's a lot of what this is talking about. A lot of the misreading of what's going on with sanctuary cities is a misreading of Marcel Mauss's The Gift, as specifically not understanding what he's saying about strangers. And he says there's this central thing that we've got to worry about with situations like urbanism. So, you know, large, complicated groups is that we're dependent on strangers. And he talks about that's a moment of constantly being in exaggerated fear, but also exaggerated generosity. And you have to have both of those in there. So that, you know, that he's talking about the need for sanctuary.
What was your favorite part of the book?
I think that it's done is my favorite part. let's see. What is my favorite part? Certainly one of the parts that not what I was thinking about the most, but came towards the end. It is this image of the key experience is just walking into the place. And, you know, that experience of going into the environment there and all the sights and the smells and the experience of being there as a central moment. And I keep thinking back to that as a way to hang all these other more abstract debates about Marcel Mauss's writing and that kind of stuff. It really is about that. And trying to understand the place from that perspective.
Do you have any future or ongoing projects that you'd like to mention on the podcast?
Sure. The biggest project I'm working on right now is an excavation in County Roscommon at a place called McDermott's Rock, which is a central place on an isle, a central place for the McDermotts, certainly in the later medieval period and probably going back further than that. I'm working with Tom Finan from St. Louis University and Jimmy Scriver from University of Minnesota Morris. They have been out there for 3 years. I was there. They've been there for 2 years. I was there last year. We're going to be there again next summer. And it's wonderful archaeology. And it's producing a phenomenal animal bone assemblage that's going to give us an opportunity to understand, you know, who's gathering on this, whatever it's a feasting retreat or this gathering spot. Who's there? What are they eating? How do they think about that? Who, you know, who's gathering there? And what does that suggest about how people in Gaelic areas were responding to all the changes in the 12th, 13th, 14th century? Fun stuff.
That sounds really fascinating. And I can't wait to hear about the results or what you find more about both the animal assemblages and the site in general. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me today to talk about your book, John.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, Danny. It was fun. I really agree. Thank you for the invitation.
Dr. Soderbergh's book, Animals and Sacred Bodies in Early Medieval Ireland, Religion and Urbanism at Clonmacnoise, is available now through Lexington Books, an imprint of the Roman and Littlefield Publishing Group. If you'd like to hear more episodes, subscribe to New Books on Irish Studies on the New Books Network website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Stitcher. Until next time, stay safe and keep reading.